Welcome from Invest Africa to all our valued members and guests. I'm Chantal Carrington, CEO of Invest Africa. It is my pleasure to present to you today Invest Africa's 2024 Outlook for Francophone Africa, the second webinar in our series of six over the next few weeks, also including West, South, North, East, and Lusophone Africa. A few years ago, I was very excited to visit Morocco for the first time around Casablanca Finance City to hold the UK Africa Financial Services Leadership Meeting, where colleagues from the various regions came together as one for the very first time. Today, we can see that countries in the region like Morocco are still expected to be on a growth trajectory. My friends in Côte d'Ivoire are always filled with optimism, and the DRC is showing improved trading and a positive government commitment. But one tries to understand how complex this landscape really is with the expected further attempts to destabilize governments, upcoming elections, to name a few. So without any further ado, I am going to hand you over to Nicholas Norberg from Africa Report, Managing Director there, who's also joined by Gwendoline from Ecobank and Tris from SRM. A quick reminder just that we will have an opportunity for Q&A towards the end of the webinar, so please do submit what is on your mind. Over to you, Nicholas.
Thank you, Chantal, and I'm very pleased to welcome you all to this webinar on Francophone Africa. My name is Nicholas Norbrook. I'm the Managing Editor of the Africa Reports, which is part of the Jeune Afrique Media Group. We also run the Africa CEO Forum, which this year will be held on the 16th and 17th of May in Kigali. I hope to see some of you there. Please don't hesitate to reach out on LinkedIn or on Twitter at Nick Norbrook and at the Africa Report. So according to the World Bank, French-speaking sub-Saharan Africa, which is a vast group of 22 countries, recorded overall economic growth of 5.1% in 2022 and was expected to hit 7% in 2023, while the rest of sub-Saharan Africa, mainly English-speaking, recorded a rate around 3%. And over the last decade, annual growth has been around 3.5% for Francophone sub-Saharan Africa and only 2.2% for the rest. So why is this such a resilient bloc, even with all the political and economic problems that we will no doubt get into over the course of the next 40 minutes? Maybe it's the link to the euro hedging inflation. Maybe it's a common framework for law. We will try to find out with our two guests, Gwendoline Abounon, who's the Managing Director and Cluster Head, CIMAC, for Ecobank Cameroon, and Tris Puri, who's Senior Associate, Francophone Africa Lead at SRM. A reminder again, as Chantal said, there is a question function at the bottom of your screen. Please don't hesitate, as they occur to you, to pop them in that box, and we will come to them in around half an hour's time. So, Gwendoline, let's start with the big picture, the big macro picture. Across the zones you look at, what's that been? Inflation, of course, has ravaged the rest of the world. Was Francophone Africa spared at all? And if so, why?
Thanks to Invest Africa for this invitation to participate in this great conversation. Because it's a topic that is, you know, on the table and on the mouths of everybody globally. When you talk about Francophone Africa, you already mentioned that there are plus 20 countries. So it's difficult to talk about them in one block. So I'll try to, you know, talk about them in individual blocks, the Central African countries and the West African Francophone countries, so that we can really dig deep into the conversations. To answer your question, no, unfortunately, we're not left out. In spite of the continued issues that we have seen with the climate change, the impacts of the COVID pandemic, the Russian-Ukraine crisis, as well as the ongoing sociopolitical crisis that we have faced in a lot of these countries, Don't forget now, we are looking only at Gabon and Niger, but we have had Central African Republic, we have had Cote d'Ivoire, we have had Burkina Faso, we have had Mali, and to a great extent, Cameroon has been going through 7 years of what is called the Anglophone crisis, as well as the issues that we have been facing on the northern part of the region with Boko Haram. So all of this came in, the inflation points came in just to further exacerbate the existing challenges that have been faced in the country. There's been political instability. There's been issues with food security. There's fiscal stability because, as you imagine, they are wrestling, all of the governments are wrestling with tax revenues, which is a vital point for economic sustainability in these countries. So the central banks have been struggling to tighten their monetary policies to see how to stabilize the currencies and to curb inflation. But unfortunately, we have seen record high inflationary rates that we have not seen in over 13 to 15 years. So unfortunately, we're not left out.
Absolutely. And I guess you can think of Francophone Africa in terms of the locomotives in both the sector and the country. So maybe Cote d'Ivoire, Senegal, and Morocco in the west and north, with agribusiness and infrastructure very strong in Cote d'Ivoire, Senegal about to enter an era of oil and gas, and Morocco with long-standing strengths in mining, phosphates particularly, and its growing manufacturing sector over the last decade, and even put the toe into the green energy waters. In the central region, Gwendolyn, what really are the locomotives in terms of the countries and also in terms of the sectors?
I think the locomotives in terms of the countries would be a Cameroon, would be a Congo-Brazzaville. I would state those two as the main locomotives. You know, Cameroon, I would say is at the center of all of the CEMAC countries in terms of support. Support not only in resources, but support because most of the other countries are landlocked. So the ports of Cameroon is very important. Support in the sense that when you look at the different boundaries or the borders, a lot of the road transportation also to provide food and necessary supplies to the other countries also comes from Cameroon. Congo-Brazzaville has had a lot of stability, I would say, compared to the other countries, because we have seen the political instability in Chad, in Central African Republic, that persists till today. And Equatorial Guinea, I would say, is just a quiet area for the last couple of years, and it is highly dependent on oil revenues. So the downward turn in prices over the years has sort of crippled Equatorial Guinea. So we have not seen a lot coming from Equatorial Guinea. And in the banking sector, we would assess the treasury bills and the bonds that are coming out of those countries to determine who are the financial giants, I would say, in this region. And again, you'll see Cameroon leading in terms of the number of bonds that are being issued, the treasury bills and the subscription. You will see Gabon that posted very high rates of above 7% with the margins of almost 10% in the past. You will see Congo-Brazzaville also that did a lot of bonds issuance and had high subscriptions. So again, those elements come to support the fact that those are the giants. But I would like us not to forget that countries like Chad and Central African Republic have proven their resilience because they have been through several years of political instability, but they have remained above the water. They haven't drowned. So, and recently with Gabon having the coup, I don't know if I would say it's a family coup. I don't know what word I should use for that type of coup. exactly. So, but before the coup, we're seeing really strong developmental projections coming out of Gabon. So Cameroon, Congo, Brazzaville, I would say are the giants, but we should keep an eye out for the other countries because they have proven to be quite resilient, and we should expect something interesting coming out of them as well.
Thanks for that, Gwendolyn. a super useful overview. And we'll come back to Gabon in a moment. Tris, on the political risk side, what for you are the really big things to watch out for over the next 12 months that are going to act as a break on business?
Yeah, thanks, Nick. So I think it's important to start broad with this and understand that the region is really undergoing quite a seismic political shift at the moment. Obviously, you know, France has historically played a very central role, both diplomatically and commercially, across the region. And the recent string of coups we've seen in places like Burkina Faso, Mali, recently Niger, obviously Gabon, they all do have their own, I guess, their own origins, and we need to take them each on their own merits. But it does speak to a sort of growing anti-French sentiment, which we've been seeing over recent years across the region, which is sort of connected to France's role in sort of providing military support across these countries over the last sort of 10 years or so. So I think the first thing to bear in mind is that, you know, this string of coups is going to, it is sort of, it does mean that there's going to be a readjustment, a recalibration, both politically and commercially in these countries. And that's going to have a knock-on effect for investors. We're seeing, you know, potential decline in French political and commercial influence in the region as certain sort of major French players have been pulling out, or some would say they've been chased out of certain countries. One thing I've been keeping an eye on is I guess the trajectory of these countries which have experienced coups in terms of things like resource nationalism and efforts to efforts to establish greater sovereignty, economic and political sovereignty. So that's something that we can talk about perhaps on this webinar, is any early indications that we're seeing of certain countries drifting more towards the resource nationalism model. And of course, you know, the impact of sanctions, which have resulted from these coups, most recently and most severely in Niger, where the sanctions regime has been extremely harsh in comparison to other sanctions measures put in place, for example, in Burkina and Mali. Again, I'm happy to go into more detail on that and how that might sort of be undermining regional trade, as well as sort of putting tensions on regional political relationships. So those are sort of the very high level issues I would be thinking about at the moment.
Well, let's go into the resource nationalism in a moment. I just wanted to get from you an understanding of the extent to which this is, I was going to say standard anti-French sentiment. I can say that because I'm half French. But there's always been anti-French resentment from their colonial involvement to their very long post-colonial involvement, which many say has never really finished. It was that just dormant and then weaponized by Russia, or is that the kind of outsider view? And actually, this is very much domestically driven. And Wagner or no Wagner, Russian interference or no Russian interference, this would have happened anyway.
It is a hard question to answer. I think you're correct that yes, there has been a sort of simmering anti-French sentiment in the region for quite a few years. Obviously, you know, France's involvement in Mali from sort of 2013 onwards, where they were providing very direct military support, and that sort of provided the basis for France to have a very strong military presence in the region, providing special forces support. And I think part of the issue that I've come across when traveling in the region is that that military support hasn't necessarily been, at least in the eyes of the local communities, hasn't been matched with an equal focus on development and sustainable development. It's been primarily a kinetic military intervention. And it's an intervention which had been quite unsuccessful because of the nature of the the nature of the conflicts which are raging across the sort of the Sahel, you know, poorest border regions are just by definition very difficult to keep under control. And I think France sort of really set itself up with a pretty tall order if they were thinking they were going to be able to combat sort of insurgent groups across the region. So there's a sense in the region that France's military interventions haven't delivered. There's also a sense that they haven't invested sufficiently in the development of the region. And I'd say those are the two sort of key issues I've come across. And you are also correct that the Russia angle is a factor. So many of the sort of senior military leaders in these countries have actually originally received training through, you know, Russian networks. And with the Wagner Group or whatever its current iteration is, essentially promising sort of military support in exchange for access to, you know, resources in many of these countries, and sort of continued military support going forwards. Those relationships, they matter, and these, you know, military leaders feel perhaps more comfortable shifting their sort of focus of gravity towards Russia now.
Gwendolyn, just on this French retreat issue, you're obviously, through your network of Ecobank clients across what I believe you call Middle Africa, you're very plugged into the economies of the region, and you've seen French banks leave in en masse, really, over the last 15 years, or perhaps less. What is the impact of that? Is this crisis? Is this opportunity? Are you facing issues in completing payments as the correspondent banking dry up? What do you expect will be the impact of seeing French economic actors slowly pull out?
Crisis, no. Opportunity, yes. I think, like Tris was mentioning, most of us have grown up in the countries, the Middle African countries, as you mentioned, knowing that French involvement is real. So seeing if we look at the banks that exited in some of our regions, some of them were bought by Moroccan banks. I will take the example of Atijari Wafa that bought into what was formerly known as Crédit Lyonnais. And recently the BMC group of Morocco still buying into BSEC. So we are seeing the exit of French investors, but we are also seeing the entry of a lot of North African investors into this Middle or Central Africa. So it is a good opportunity. The second thing is, you know, that narrowed view of correspondent banking being limited to French banks has been gone for at least 10 or more years. We have seen American correspondent banks, German correspondent banks, South African correspondent bank, even Qatar National Bank has come in as correspondent banks. So we've had now a more holistic basket of correspondent banking that are working in the Middle African countries. And that has really helped to foster growth and investment for the financial institutions and the companies locally, because now there's more competitive pricing and there are more opportunities and there's more risk appetite for some of the sectors that historically were not open or eligible for some of those correspondent bank activities. We've also seen, I'm sure you've read about investors coming in for the mining sector in some of our areas that were not previously done in the past. But these investors are coming from Australia, they are coming from South Africa, some are even British. So I think that it's more of an opportunity to have many more players coming in because they come with different views and visions. And I think it helps us to have a more holistic idea of how we can push forward the economic development of the countries in which we operate. So opportunity for me is the key word. It's a lot of opportunities just brimming around, and it's better for us to have more, a greater variety of nationals coming in to participate in this.
Fantastic. Tris, the Sahel coups appeared to be a bit more revolutionary, rejecting the old order in nature, whereas the coup in Gabon feels more like a reshuffling of the elites, more like a palace coup. How is that playing out for businesses? And how does that conjugate with this idea of resource nationalism? Because even though Gabon felt, you know, more of a soft coup, if you can call it that, they're playing hardball with a French energy company at the moment, Maurice and Prom, for, you know, economic nationalism reasons.
Yeah. So it's important not to sort of generalize too much when we talk about coups and what this means for economic actors. But I think if you look at places like Burkina Faso and Mali, just to start with the resource nationalism point, we're seeing very preliminary indications of both military administrations looking to pass new mining codes, for example, which would increase some royalties owed to government on key mining projects. So, for example, in I think it was October 2023, Mali adopted a new mining code. It's still being debated, but it would essentially call for obviously higher royalty payments to the government, as well as more locals have to be employed in top positions in mining operations, and caps on expat salaries, etc. And obviously Canadian mining firms who are very involved in the region are sort of in talks with the government on this, trying to convince them to walk back on these reforms. We're seeing similar potential movements in Burkina Faso. Late last year, the government announced they would be essentially linking gold royalties to government, gold royalties owed to the government to the gold price, rather than having it capped at 5% as it has been before, which could result in pretty significant cuts in profits for gold operators. In terms of Gabon, so you're right that this is it's a little bit of a different animal to the coups we've seen in elsewhere in the region. Coups in Burkina, Mali, again, don't want to generalize, but they've predominantly been driven by deteriorating insecurity, as well as growing public frustrations over sort of lack of key public services and accountability within government. It's always been a slight mix of those different factors. And obviously it's more complicated than that, but just for the purposes of keeping this brief, in Gabon, what we've seen is essentially a sort of family feud where there's been growing frustration within the political elite over governance and essentially sort of management of the country within Ali Bongo's administration, as well as after Ali Bongo's stroke a few years ago, doubts over his capacity to actually lead effectively. Rather than sort of some random military leader taking over, we've seen Ali Bongo's cousin, General Nguema, take power, who's very much ingrained within that Bongo family network. And in terms of what this means for investors, there's a few things. I mean, it's not as seismic a shift as some people might think it would be. There's actually been quite a significant degree of continuity. The new regime has sort of gone to great lengths to, you know, stress to investors that, you know, the constitution essentially remains the same as the sort of legal frameworks. There's no plans to dramatically revise the oil or the mining codes. State contracts that have already been put in place are being honored. And, you know, the day after the coup took place, Perenco was lifting sort of large cargoes of crude, and, you know, quite a few operators. Tullow Oil has indicated its operations have been largely unaffected so far. At the same time, there's a few sort of, I guess there's a few things to look out for. The first is General Nguema has announced a pretty robust, he's not calling it an audit, but it's essentially what it is, of financial transactions under the previous administration. Essentially looking at, you know, government debts and any potential impropriety surrounding those transactions. And it may be that some major actors do come in the firing line, but that's a sort of wait and see sort of scenario. When it comes to Morel and Prom, for example, they had been negotiating to acquire Carlyle's assets in Gabon prior to the coup. And what we're now seeing is that entire negotiation is slightly hanging in the air, because you've now got, they essentially need the backing of the new government, which has not yet been forthcoming. They were the preferred bidders on that, on those assets originally, but you've now got other players like Perenco sort of circling, who are also interested. So I think anyone who was involved in negotiations prior to this coup may find that those negotiations are being slightly derailed or need to be readjusted slightly.
Great. Gwendolyn, let's drill down into Cameroon. She's seen some positive signs recently, some energy sector reforms, potential opening of the Nachtigal Dam, although I'm not quite sure when. But we're going to probably see the exit of some investors in the power sector also. Again, an opportunity for investors. How do you see the outlook for Cameroon?
I think the outlook for Cameroon is positive. When you read what is written in a lot of newspapers and in a lot of publications, it gives a sort of bleak outlook. But for me, who is actually an active player in the economic space, the financial space, I think the outlook is instead positive. Why do I say positive? There's a lot to be done. We still have not achieved the full potential of our economic and development plan, which was scheduled to really be finalized in 2035. So there's still a lot of opportunities to invest in infrastructure, in transport, in telecoms, in the health sector, in education. I mean, the potential is huge. There is a wait and see attitude where people are, investors are waiting to see what will be the outcome. But I think it's actually the right time to come in right now to be well positioned to do so. You mentioned the energy sector. We see actors indicating they are not going to stay till the end of their mandate. This is a huge opportunity because with all of the investments done in Nachtigal and the other dam projects, we have not yet completed the transmission of the energy that these dams are going to generate to the different regions. Huge opportunity. Huge opportunity. We see Sonara, that since the 2019 fire incident has not been rebuilt. Huge opportunity again, because it should be done by public-private partnerships. You see the road infrastructure, because you cannot talk about development when you don't talk about road infrastructure. The road infrastructure connecting the different towns, still largely undeveloped. Again, huge opportunity. So I think instead of the wait and see attitude that we see from some investors, I think it should be more get in and be a first, I'll put it, be on the first, the front line, so that when things do take off, you'll be well positioned to be able to be at the heart of all the opportunities that are available in the different sectors.
Gwendolyn, can I contrast that with one of the questions that we've received about doing business in Cameroon, a perception that there's a lot of red tape, especially for formal business transactions, while the informal sector just continues. and particularly in the FMCG sector. Any tips for doing business in Cameroon to get around that red tape?
I didn't want to refer, I was reading that question and saying, oh, I wish the investee or Cameroon people were online. But from a practitioner's point of view, I do agree that whenever data is not available, whenever there's no well-defined policies and procedures, red tape will be the answer. And that is the case in Cameroon. So you have to know your way around to be able to get things done. But the government has put in place a Cameroon Investment Office in Douala and in Yaoundé. And I think they are also available online to help guide investors on where you have to go and what you have to do. I think what is missing there is the publicity. Because like I said, if people do not have access to the information, even though it exists, it makes it difficult for it to be applicable. The second thing is that since the 2019 foreign exchange regulation that changed and really, I would say, tightened ease of transfer of money out of the country, there's been a lot of shrinking in what can be done in terms of inter-trade between the countries. And while it is a good thing, because we understand why the central bank had to take such measures to be able to give the country the necessary buffer for foreign currency, at the same time, you've seen that they have had maybe over 15 or 16 amendments to the regulation to be able to facilitate more the trade access. So the informal sector also has to start using or benefiting from some of the fallouts of the African Continental Free Trade Agreements. You've seen institutions like us, Ecobank, we have put in place a single trade hub, single market trade hub, which allows those exporting and importing to have a payment platform to make their payments. They should also tap into what the Afroexim Bank has done in terms of the PAPS payment platform also to try to bring that informal trade to a formal platform. And that will help the financial inclusion goals. Because if you look at Cameroon with a 27 million population and only 30% are banked, you see that the margin for growth in terms of financial inclusion is great. And it is in that entrepreneurial space, that informal space, where banks have to work with telcos, have to work with fintechs to see how we can bring people out of the informal sector into the formal sector. That all would help and exactly. Hopefully ease up on how we can do business better in Cameroon.
Thanks for tackling several of the questions. That's great. Tris, I won't ask you which country President Biya is currently in, but he is, if not already, he's approaching his 10th decade. And a lot of people are wondering about the post-Biya future for Cameroon. It's a question that's been discussed over many, many a dinner table in Yaoundé and Douala. What for you are the three most likely scenarios for how a transition might go?
So it's an interesting one in Cameroon because President Biya has been pretty masterful in how he's maintained his grip on power. He's very much established himself for a system in which he is, you know, the top dog, and any sort of outward expressions of wishes to succeed him wouldn't necessarily be well received, I think. And that what that means is that nobody yet has actually sort of publicly voiced any ambition to replace President Biya in 2025. I think that's because they don't want to jeopardize their current positions in government. And a lot of the maneuvering ahead of this election is really taking place behind the scenes. And what we're seeing is different factions emerging within the political elite, aligning themselves behind different individuals who are most likely to be in a position to take power. I mean, what I can do is I can run through some of who I think are some of the most likely contenders. The first would be Ferdinand Ungo, who's the Secretary General to the presidency. He essentially, as you say, B, has been sort of out of the country a lot. He's getting quite old now, very old. Ferdinand has essentially been running the country on Beer's behalf. Beer trusts him, you know, Ferdinand has permission to sign the president's name on official documents. He has pretty considerable influence over the military. Many believe he does have ambitions to be the next president. He just can't explicitly say it yet. Another would be the current finance minister, Louis-Paul Motazé. He's the nephew of President Beer. Again, hasn't publicly voiced his ambitions, but based on my travels in country, his name is being thrown around a lot as a potential successor. Another would be Frank Beer, President Beer's son, who has been becoming, he's been quite absent from the political space in the past. He's generally just kept himself to himself, been working and studying abroad, but is starting to become a little bit more visible on the political scene. And in terms of the opposition, there's not really much opposition to be spoken of. There's the main opposition party led by Maurice Kamto, who's been sort of in and out of prison for the last few years, and there's been quite a few sort of tensions around that. The opposition hasn't really unified into a cohesive block, which really stands a chance of sort of overriding President Beer's, you know, control over the state machinery. In terms of different scenarios, I guess that the most immediate thing that we want to think about is if President Beer does die in office or is incapacitated, in which case, because he's kind of voiced no intentions to actually step down, so he's going to have to pass away, what would essentially happen is the Speaker of the Senate, who's called Marcel Njifengi, who's 88, would take over in the interim. And there'd then have to be another sort of handing over of power to whoever is best positioned. I think whoever does take over power, again, this is just speculation, is probably going to want to continue what President Beer has done in terms of keeping a very tight control over the military, as well as continuing to attract foreign investment into key sectors, so things like timber, extractives, financial services. I think we can probably expect continuity on most of those fronts. I wouldn't expect any drastic policy shifts, but again, it's slightly speculative at this stage.
Could we try and tackle some of these questions which point towards the supranational bodies on the continent? So we have questions about, you know, whether ECOWAS is still relevant. President Tinubu came out very strongly, against the coup in Niger, but his bluff has been called and ECOWAS is looking toothless again. And then we have the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement, which is a first, I think, in the civilization on this planet to try and create growth of individual countries within a free trade zone. It's not how it's worked before. Very ambitious plan. And just as, you know, European solidarity is tested in difficult economic times, I think it's very difficult at the moment for some of the key parts of the AfCFTA to come into force. Tris and Gwendolyn, maybe you can both speak to your thoughts about how these tensions between the national desires and of countries in the Francophone zone are in tension or not with these larger structures. Maybe Tris, you can give us the political risk side, and Gwendolyn, you can finish with the economic.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what we are seeing, in my opinion, is a slight breakdown in the cohesiveness of ECOWAS from a political perspective. As I've said already, we're starting to see more of these countries wanting to forge their own paths and starting to sort of formulate their own political, I guess, alliances. For example, Burkina Faso, Mali started to shift more towards Russia. And I think it can also be seen at the level of, for example, the G5 Sahel, which, for those who don't know, is was a security alliance in the Sahel, which was sort of overseen by France, but sort of driven by countries like Burkina, Mali. And what's happened is over time, that alliance has eroded and recently dissolved. And I think it just speaks to a slight deterioration in that sort of we're in this together sort of mentality. That for a while there was that prevailing mentality of, in order to establish security in the region, we need to work together and harness our combined powers. As countries have gradually sort of dropped out of that alliance, it just signals to me a slight shift in that mentality.
Great. And Gwendolyn, in your answer, which may well be the final word, it would be great if you could speak to, obviously you've mentioned the Pan-African payment system, but one of the other sort of supranational economic organizations is the currency. And there are, you know, mutterings about Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger wishing to leave the Western CFA currency block.
Absolutely. I was looking forward to this question because it is so critical. You know, trade is one of the main things that is going to help us grow or develop our African economies. And the mention of ECOWAS, I think, has its place because historically it was one of the first regional trade kind of corporations. So it was a starting point. We are not at the desired level of success. And that's why I think that coupled with our existing challenges, be it regional integration, non-convertibility of our currencies, trade policy or poor regulatory environments or inadequate basic infrastructure, one of the reasons why the AFTAC is not taking off the way it should, because many of the countries still have to eliminate existing issues, tariffs and non-tariff barriers to trade in goods, liberalizing trade in services, complex custom procedures, different product standards, licensing requirements. And one of the key things that people don't talk about and which we should is the negative effect also that some of the countries are fearing due to this liberalized trade. For example, there will be a fall in public revenue from lost tariff income. There will be illicit financial flows. It exists now, but it will be exacerbated when this is liberalized fully. And then there's going to be migration of scarce skills from low to higher income African countries. So I think all of these reasons, all of these issues is what is hampering or not enabling the AFTAC to really take off as it should. Now, are countries ready to unpeg themselves from foreign currencies? In my humble opinion, I think not yet, because if you want to unpeg yourself, you have to be financially strong to be able to withstand the headwinds. We have seen the impact of what just the fluctuation in the currencies, what it has caused in some of these economies. And if they are not prepared, first of all, there are socio-political issues, the economies are not fully stable, trade is not where it should be. I think that there should be a more planned approach to how we unpeg. And should we unpeg, we should have a plan of how we are going to actually put this regional integration into place. Because at the end of the day, if you have your own currency and it is just your own currency and it's not able to be traded across various countries, I think the ultimate aim that you have will not be achieved. So in my humble opinion, it is good for us to start thinking about unpegging ourselves, because we cannot be pegged forever, but we should really have concise and deliberate measures that are going to be put in place, tested, before we gradually unpeg ourselves in stages.
Thank you so much, Gwendolyn. And thank you, Tris. And sadly, we will have to unpeg ourselves from this very interesting conversation and hand you back to Chantal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nicholas. I think you will all agree that this panel was constructive, a great insight for a complex outlook. We've heard things like watching the trajectory. We heard about the data and information availability, not being out there, but maybe sitting in an investment office. We heard about the general bleak outlook, but actually on the ground, it being very positive. And I think that we also raised that, you know, this underdeveloped opportunity, we should have a foot in the door. And once it's ready, we can open it much further. So thank you very much for this fantastic moderating, Nicholas. And thank you to Gwendolyn and Tris for your thought-provoking views that we can now go and digest and consider in our planning for Francophone Africa for this year. A quick reminder that a recording of this webcast will also be available to share with your colleagues and other interested parties who may also find it helpful. Please join us again on Monday next week for Invest Africa's Outlook for Southern Africa. That brings our Invest Africa Outlook for Francophone Africa 2024 to a close. Thank you very much for participating. Goodbye until next time.